Well, good morning, everyone, and it's great to be here in Tampa. I just left home at 25 degrees and following three snowstorms, so it's really good to be in a warm place. I'm still working on that air humidity part, but I think we'll work it out by the end of the day. So I'm going to talk about terrestrial carbon and nitrogen 8 years after massive-scale Bartonella epidemic in western U.S., and I would like to credit my two undergraduate students, who's pretty much results contributed to the majority of my talk. Ada Harris and Susan Schmidt, they were my NSF interns for a number of years, and pretty much the whole project evolved around them asking the questions. So as we all know that beetles pretty much were significant vectors of the presence of a blue stain fungus in a majority of coniferous trees in especially Colorado and Wyoming and other parts of the western U.S. and obviously decimated the entire stands of lodgepole pine, a lot of subalpine fir and spruce. And we actually, this picture was taken at the Gliese station. We actually were able to take the imaginary prior to the infestation where beetles were sort of endemic until a number of years later where they became epidemic. When it came to lodgepole pine lower elevation, sometimes the stands would be up to 100% decimated. So we're talking about the whole presence of the beetle and the impact it has on biogeochemistry, on stand structure, and following a variety of other ecological consequences. And the paper that Steve Edberg put together in 2012 was sort of putting this projectile predictive responses of both biogeochemistry and tree stands, a variety of respiration, ecosystem productivity, nitrogen availability, and so on. And we were actually sort of right now gearing toward a stage of moving from the years to the decades. It's been over 10 years we've had beetle in our area. And one of the things for sure is that we have way earlier that tree fall, and it has a lot to do with the fact that there's a lot of wind in Wyoming. But what we're working on nitrogen availability, and we're asking a lot of questions about the tree stands. So shortly after the outbreak, we've done some chronosequence studies where we've noticed that up to 5 years, we still have increasing changes in the nitrogen pools. And we have increased in nitrate concentrations, both litter and the soil, and we also had quite a bit of an increase in nitrous oxide emissions to the magnitude comparable sometimes to, let's say, cornfield in western Nebraska. Methane also sort of subsided, so there was a reduced assimilation, and then sometimes we had tendency of increased methane production. When we look at the understory vegetation, it was a really interesting thing that we've noticed. We have anywhere from a zero that would be present in obviously uninfested stands all the way to about 60% of the vegetation cover. So all the forest stands were pretty much filled up with this understory vegetation that was doing really well and hopefully attenuating and benefiting from this excess of nitrogen in the soil. And that's in the lodgepole pine stand that was hit by over 90%. So 8 years after the infestation, we thought we have some sort of a good understanding of what's happening, just completely decimated stands, but you know, landscape is more heterogeneous. We were looking at mainly forest stands that were partially infested. We were also trying to see how things sort of evolved in the stands of different species composition. So we were looking at the impact of beetle-induced tree mortality on vegetation succession and terrestrial ecosystem carbon and nitrogen in three different types of forest in the one watershed. And that was a part of the former EBSCOR grant that we used to look at the biogeochemistry. And the study site was very nice to attend and visit. My students obviously loved coming up here on a regular basis, more so because right as you drive out of the forests, you end up in town with an amazing ice cream store. So they were doing it on a weekly basis, in fact, so that was good. So what we've traveled around and noticed that anywhere in the watersheds between 9 and 10,000 feet above the elevation, we were able to, in a small sort of a constrained space, we were able to kind of go across three different forest types. And so looking at the watershed slash sort of different forest type sand composition, we were able to look at the watershed hydrology and bark beetle infestation across these different stands. So we had three slope positions that were unique. We had what they call toe slope, foot slope, and a shoulder slope. And within each, we were able to identify five well-defined sort of clusters of dead versus live trees. And then obviously the soils are extremely undeveloped. They and the soils mainly formed on mixed colluvium, metamorphic schist, and then it's a pretty much snowpack-dominated system. The first time we entered the site was at the end of May after the finals, still working in the snow. So we did a lot of vegetation sampling, mainly concentrating on vegetation composition, opportunity for students to learn how to do the tree inventory and so on, root sampling. We also did a lot of soil and trace gas sampling for the purpose of the real objective of this proposal that sort of evolved a little different, but we thought this is an important part to understand as well. Lots of questions, lots of answers, lots of good presentations. So what we determined was that at the three different unique locations, we had at the toe slope, we had forest clusters that were dominated by Engelmann spruce with a small, very small percentage of lodgepole pine. In a foot slope, we had a transition between subalpine fir and lodgepole pine, and then upwards at the shoulder, we had this really drier, sort of warmer forest dominated by lodgepole pine. And all across board, we calculated it was about 30 or to 32% of forest mortality, which allowed us to make some inferences. I'm going to go fast. So let's talk about vegetation first. We had generally in this toe slope location, we had about 10 times as great seedling density in dead clusters compared to the live clusters. So obviously the understory recruitment is way more sort of dynamic. We are missing, we're losing lodgepole pine from this stand. In a foot slope that were equilibrated subalpine fern lodgepole pine, we had again 10 times as greater seedling recruitment. Again, no lodgepole pine recovery. We are losing that from that stand as well. And in a shoulder, the seedling recruitment is only double the original uninfested stands. Lodgepole pine comes back, but also we're getting quite a presence of a shade-tolerant subalpine fir. So we're talking about some potential transitions in the forest species composition over time. So in summary, we have transitioning of this forest to greater stands, more presence of shade-tolerant species, and then less presence of lodgepole pine in initial stands that are still have a canopy cover of shade-intolerant. So we also calculated terrestrial carbon nitrogen, and the students really insisted on looking at it as a sum of nitrogen and carbon in variety of roots, soil, 0 to 10 centimeters litter, and above ground understory vegetation. And we noticed that across board, the only differences we noticed were still in the lodgepole pine dominated treatments in the shoulder slope dead species, dead stands where majority of it was lodgepole pine. It had a longest impact. The majority of it came from the large biomass of understory biomass and litter. In contrast to obviously to the slopes, toe slope, where majority of it was attributed to the litter and the soil, nitrogen in the soil. Same goes with the carbon, terrestrial carbon, but similar pattern. So the drier trees, drier stands actually do retain longer lasting legacy of having a presence of bark beetle, sort of a damage or alteration of biotic chemistry at least 8 years after. So in summary, we talk about the fact that the forests dominated by lodgepole pine are the only forests with differences in terrestrial carbon and nitrogen caused by beetle infestation, and obviously the longer lasting consequences in stands where beetle may be greater than 30%, right? Because if we talk about that. So here is one more additional thing. The students did do the weekly base on a weekly basis trace gas emissions, and following to what Scott had also, we've divided it into different seasons. We had snow melt, spring, summer, and the fall, and we looked across the landscape. So we've noticed consistently that the food slope usually generates the highest amount of CO2 and nitrous oxide during the snow melt. Interestingly, this data corresponded with similar increases in total dissolved nitrogen. It was driven by dissolved organic nitrogen during the snowmelt phase. So we think this is sort of like a hotspot still. The shoulder area, the toe slope area, I'm sorry, and the shoulder were impacted by some sort of really quick climatic differences. We still were pretty much sampling during the snow, over the snow, during the running creeks, it was really, really cold. While these were the warmest spots, and then obviously it seems like there's a little bit of an out-of-sync relationship. we still see consistently greater amount of nitrous oxide emissions during the snow melt in clusters of, from clusters of trees that were dead, suggesting that there's still some sort of a synchrony. And if you overlay those dead trees and the greater presence of the dead trees in a food slope area, you may end up with the sort of a greater impact on the sort of a synchrony of nitrogen in the system still. So in conclusions, the students and we all saw that recovering understory vegetation play critical roles in nitrogen attenuation in this forest. Nitrous oxide doubled during the snow melt, and that can have important consequences, obviously, especially in forests that can experience complete mortality, like lower elevation, lodgepole pines. We do have, we think, the hot spots, the low attenuation zones, and we think the food slopes are really critical for that understanding of subsurface lateral flow, but also the vegetation recovery and so on, we do see significant changes in the species composition, and then so what we're sort of speculating is that at some point end demand will likely exceed the nitrogen supply, especially in this heavily recruited stands, and then it may also result in, just because of a competition, an early onset of nitrogen deficiency and premature self-thinning of those stands. So we may have a lot of dog hair stands, but we also may have a lot of mortality caused by pests and disease as well. How do I go back? Just wanted to acknowledge the presence of all these students. A whole bunch of them, lots of interesting pets that came along as well, lots of great faculty and staff that were sort of invested in mentoring undergraduate students in sort of promoting their presence in the STEM sciences, and then the funding came from NSF Apps for seed grants. So thank you all, and how many more minutes do I have? Oh, I timed it just right. Thank you. Yes, so I would say that there's more opening in a canopy for sure, and then this area would warm up way faster compared to the toe slope as well. well, if you go upwards, almost the summit and the shoulder, it's even way warmer, but it was just completely dry and the soil probably got even more skeletal. So the we probably missed the poles of the high nitrous oxide emissions earlier in the spring when it really melted way early, but we were not able to access the sites yet. So.